Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Hardy Merriman, a researcher and trainer that supported anti-authoritarian mobilizations around the world, who examines the strengths and effectiveness of the growing U.S. anti-Trump No Kings movement. Greg Consalves, associate professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health, who talks about the group he founded, Defend Public Health, that's countering Trump and RFK Jr.'s attack on proven science-based public health policies. And David Paul of the Task Force on the Americas, who assesses the Trump regime's lethal attacks on what they claim are drug smugglers' boats in the Caribbean and escalating military threats targeting Venezuela. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Sudan's paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, claims it has captured the western city of El Fasher, marking a turning point in the nation's civil war. The loss would be a huge blow to the Sudanese army, as El Fasher is its last remaining foothold in the Darfur region, leaving the RSF effectively in control of the area. For some 18 months, the RSF had surrounded El Fasher and blocked all humanitarian supplies from getting in. Before its capture, humanitarian aid groups described the city as no longer habitable, with most homes destroyed and the thousands who remain suffering from high rates of malnutrition. UN investigators have accused the RSF of committing numerous crimes against humanity during the siege. The U.S. had said the RSF has committed genocide targeting Darfur's non-Arab population. After top commanders of the RSF and Sudanese army engaged in a power struggle, setting off a brutal civil war in 2023, more than 150,000 people have died across the country, and about 12 million have fled their homes, creating one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. For years, Iraqi Kurdistan was an island of stability in the often volatile nation. Now, factions within Kurdistan are fighting each other as the unity of earlier times has vanished. In August, street battles erupted in Sulaymaniyah, Kurdistan's second-largest city, between forces loyal to Baful Talabani, leader of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan Party, and his cousin Lahore Talabani, former PUK co-leader and now head of the opposition People's Front Party. The recent violence was triggered after security forces loyal to Baful attempted to arrest Lahore under a judicial order. The rift between Baful, son of the former Iraqi president, and Lahore dates back to 2021, when Baful ousted his cousin from the PUK co-leadership, accusing him of corruption and running a parallel security apparatus. While Baghdad tries to remain neutral, Iran is closely watching developments in a city with which it maintains strong security and economic ties. This latest conflict in Kurdistan exposes the fragility of the enclave's internal power structure and the risk that the conflict could draw in regional powers and Iraq as a whole. For decades, seasonal work H-2A visas have failed to protect farm workers from wage theft, fraud, forced labor, and violence. A federal investigation found that many workers in the program have had their wages stolen and been threatened with deportation by employers if they complain about unsafe working conditions. In the worst instances, others have been assaulted or raped or even died. ProPublica reports that in one of the nation's most serious and expansive H-2A criminal cases, a federal judge described the abuse of these workers as a form of modern-day slavery. Without further changes to the H-2A program, labor advocates say foreign farm workers will likely continue to be harmed. However, there's a growing movement focused on the belief that the power of consumers can be leveraged to end agricultural abuses. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a human rights organization, launched the Fair Food Program in 2011, where corporate buyers such as supermarkets and fast food chains sign legally binding agreements to buy ethically sourced crops from farms that adhere to the program's stringent set of worker protections. If abuses like forced labor are found on those farms, the buyers commit to suspending produce orders until the issues are addressed. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump was elected in November 2024 and moved back to the White House in January, the U.S. has witnessed an unprecedented authoritarian takeover of the federal government, sidelining both Congress and the courts. Mr. Trump and his supporters' clear goal is to make real their vision of a unitary executive who is exempt from all checks and balances mandated by the U.S. Constitution. In response to Trump's many autocratic actions, that include deploying the U.S. military to Democratic Party-controlled cities, threats targeting media outlets, universities, and law firms, prosecution of his perceived political enemies, and defying due process and the rule of law in his mass deportation campaign, a surprisingly powerful civil resistance movement has been organized across the country. On the second No Kings Day on October 18th, a broad-based national coalition mobilized 7 million people to demonstrate against Trump's autocratic rule at 2,700 rally sites in all 50 states, likely the largest single day of protest in U.S. history. Your reporter spoke with Hardy Merriman, former president of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, who has 20 years of research and training experience focused on support for nonviolent civil resistance movements fighting authoritarian governments around the world. Here he assesses the direction and effectiveness of the U.S. anti-fascist movement and what new strategies and tactics may be needed to confront Trump's increasingly tyrannical and corrupt rule.
So having looked at backsliding democracies and democracies that have broken down into authoritarianism, really now for the last decade, I can say that the pace of decline and erosion and breakdown of the United States has been alarming, actually. I can't think of another country that has broken down this quickly, except for a country that experienced a coup, for example. There are some similarities to actually what we experienced, particularly in the early days of the Trump administration and the coup, with regards to the way that DOGE immediately moved very quickly to seize elements of critical infrastructure. Autocrats have a playbook. It's very clear that members of this administration have looked at what autocrats have done around the world and are trying to emulate it and speed it up. The other piece, though, is that actually those of us who want to uphold democracy and push actually not to go back, but to actually make it better, to push back against authoritarianism and try to move this country in a better direction even than the one we came from, there's a playbook for that, too. It's less well known, but we can learn a ton from both research as well as what other people have done around the world. But the rate of decline has been shocking. There are scholars who now argue that we have crossed the line from being a democratic country into functionally a more authoritarian country. We would not be the worst authoritarian government in the world by any stretch, but that actually we are beginning to resemble more of an authoritarian regime than a democratic regime, and I would have to agree with that. At this point, institutions are compromised. They are still very worth investing in. We need to support elections. We need to invest heavily in lawsuits, elections, and all the institutional mechanisms that have worked in democracy. But that by itself, probably that won't be enough. That we're also going to have to organize a broader pro-democracy movement to push back as well, which is something we haven't had to do in this country in decades. But it is something that very likely needs to happen now in order to stop the continued breakdown of the United States government. I cannot underscore enough how remarkable the achievement of 7 million people is. And those numbers still have to be verified, but it's looking quite likely that this was the largest protest in U.S. history. And if, in fact, it was 7 million people, by my calculations, about 2.1% of the U.S. population, that is absolutely massive. When we compare it, even with international examples, it's absolutely a huge percentage to get in a protest. The media cycle and the news cycle move so quickly. It seems like now, you know, that was something that happened a week or two ago. That was something that seems old. It is actually something that we should dwell on. It is something we should continue to focus on because it is so unprecedented and so remarkable.
Hardy, as you examine the Trump regime's rapid implementation of their authoritarian agenda, as you said, quite alarming, and how quick it's happened over these past 9 or so months, what new creative tactics and strategies may be needed to confront what many believe could be an effort by Trump and the Republican Party to burn the U.S. Constitution and completely extinguish our democratic form of government in favor of what some believe is a fascist takeover?
They do not want us to recognize our power. They are not talking about no kings anymore. That's why we should. They would love to change the topic. They would love to turn it to the East Wing of the White House or anything else. And don't get me wrong, the demolition of the East Wing of the White House, the lawlessness of this administration is all stuff that we should focus on. But we should not let it distract from the lessons and the successes that we've had of what our strength can be. So acts of non-cooperation are incredibly powerful. And when people strike, when people boycott, when people do work slowdowns or other things, it can shift the balance of power between a movement and those who are enabling authoritarians. No administration can do what they're doing without enablers. They can't do what they're doing without corporations cooperating. Is ICE operating every single flight? No, they're chartering flights. Who's doing the data processing for the administration? When you look closely at how the administration is able to enact its authoritarian agenda, there are corporations involved in many, many places. Not all of them are going to be easy to pressure, but it's also not essential to pressure all of them. They are enablers, and you can find key points where people can start to engage in boycotts or engage in other forms of nonviolent pressure to shift them in the same way they did with Disney. And so I think understanding the network of enablers that are supporting through their actions some of the worst excesses of this administration, and then identifying points of leverage for the movement is going to be really important. The protests matter, but they're going to matter even more if they become on-ramps for non-cooperation. I also think blue states have more power than they have used at this point, and I think they need to start thinking more creatively about how they can bring particularly the economic power of blue states to bear also on some of the enablers of authoritarianism.
That was Hardy Merriman, a researcher and trainer in support of nonviolent civil resistance movements fighting authoritarian governments around the world. Find more analysis and commentary about the U.S. anti-Trump, pro-democracy civil resistance movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Soon after the 2024 presidential election, many people in the public health field were terrified about what was going to happen with U.S. public health policies under a second Trump administration, with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at the helm of the Department of Health and Human Services. A group that emerged from that concern is a volunteer organization called Defend Public Health. It's now building state chapters across the U.S. with the mission to protect the health of all from the Trump administration's cruel attacks on proven science-based public health policies. The group came together when Greg Consalves, an associate professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health, reached out to his extensive network, and thousands responded. As a young gay man in the 1990s, he joined ACT UP, a direct action group demanding HIV research and treatment for those living with HIV/AIDS. He worked on research and drug development and co-founded the Treatment Action Group. He also spent time in South Africa supporting that country's battle against HIV/AIDS. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Greg Consalves, a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship in 2018, who describes Defend Public Health's work over the past year and the future prospect for repairing the damage done to U.S. public health policy.
We initially focused on the appointments or nominations being made to key federal posts by newly inaugurated President Trump. So we opposed the RFK nomination and got thousands of letters to go into the U.S. Senate. in opposition to his candidacy. Dave Weldon, who was supposed to be the CDC director, we also targeted him for rejection by the Congress and the Senate for confirmation, and he withdrew. So we've done sort of straight up sort of advocacy. We've done the blooper of the week, where we have our scientists and clinicians and residents talk about the bloopers of the week coming out of HHS and Secretary Kennedy's office and the administration. We have a postcard campaign to let people know that clinicians and scientists don't support the Secretary of Health and Human Services as a leader of health and science in America. So we cover the waterfront, lobbying our elected officials on the budget, to appointments, to letting people know about what's happening with different decisions being made by this administration, whether it's the gutting of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices or the changes in the COVID vaccine recommendations. And as we've just been discussing, we've really begun to think that the action really is at the state and local level, and want to start to organize at those levels, because we think that's where we can build power. It's very hard to affect what happens in Washington, D.C. It's a little less daunting to figure out what's happening in Connecticut or states in which you live, where you have much more experience and real-world contacts.
What's in the Advancing the Health of America report?
The report was called Improving the Health of Americans Together. And we had several key issues that we wanted to focus on: ensuring food safety, security, and access, improving opportunities for physical activity for people, making sure we have equitable access to vaccines, we have expanded access to healthcare, that we support comprehensive sexual and reproductive healthcare access, that we fully fund scientific research and public health systems, and build strategies for clean air, and combat scientific misinformation and reduce gun violence. And the penultimate part of that report was that Secretary Kennedy needs to be removed because he is not interested in improving the health of all Americans.
Greg Gonzalez, your group also works with those most directly impacted by these cuts and changes in federal government policy, right?
In order to grow Defend Public Health as state teams, we need to understand what people care about. While cuts to NIH research or changes at the Food and Drug Administration or CDC are desperately important policy issues that we advocate for, what is really going to sort of hit home with most people around the United States are cuts to programs they rely on: Medicaid, Medicare, the ACEA, premium subsidies, the cuts to food assistance and SNAP, the cuts, you know, coming down the line to housing, the restrictions on many kinds of public services based on immigration status, et cetera. And so all of this is under the big umbrella of what we consider public health. You know, public health is not just sort of things that you think of directly as health-related, like vaccines, but it's what we call the social determinants of health, which include housing and nutrition and all these things that keep us healthy on a day-to-day basis.
Do you have much hope of the U.S. coming out the other side of this very dark period we're in?
We've faced challenges before in the 1980s, spent several years working as a volunteer at night with ACT UP, and then started a group called the Treatment Action Group in the early 90s, which focused specifically on scientific policy on research and drug development. And then in the 2000s, ended up in South Africa to fight for access to AIDS drugs, including the ones that are keeping me alive right now that were available in the United States in the mid-1990s, but really weren't available until early this century in the rest of the world. Nobody would have thought that a small band of men who have sex with men, gay men, and their allies would be able to change the world of biomedical research and drug development, or that the South Africans would get rid of their president and health minister and go from having a government that said HIV didn't cause AIDS and AIDS drugs were poison to having the largest antiretroviral AIDS drug program in the world. And so we have a proud history of being able to beat the odds, and I think we'll beat the odds and we'll beat RFK and these people who are not there to defend public health but destroy it.
That was Greg Gonsalves, an associate professor of epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health and a founder of the group Defend Public Health. Learn more about the group's mission to counter Trump and RFK Jr.'s attack on proven science-based public health policies by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since September, President Trump has authorized a series of U.S. military strikes on small boats in the Caribbean, off the coast of Venezuela, and in the Pacific Ocean, that he claims are being used to smuggle drugs from South America into the U.S. These drone and missile strikes launched in international waters has, as of October 28th, killed at least 57 people. While the Trump regime has designated drug cartels as unlawful combatants to justify their deadly military actions, legal scholars and human rights advocates have widely condemned this reasoning as a clear violation of international law. On October 24th, the president ordered the aircraft carrier USS Gerald R. Ford and its strike group with dozens of stealth fighter jets and surveillance aircraft from Europe to the Caribbean to expand military operations against drug traffickers there. But Trump has repeatedly indicated that the real target of his military deployments may be to remove Venezuela's president Nicolas Maduro from power. Earlier in the month, the president authorized the CIA to conduct covert actions inside Venezuela. For the people of Latin America, this is an alarming echo of America's gunboat diplomacy, where the U.S. military has intervened dozens of times across the hemisphere, beginning in the early 19th century, to foment coups, depose heads of state, or install Washington-approved right-wing dictators. Your reporter spoke with David Paul, a member of the Task Force on the Americas, who assesses the Trump regime's escalating military threats against Venezuela, Colombia, and Latin America, and the reaction of the Venezuelan military and ordinary Venezuelans who would likely suffer in any future U.S. attack or invasion of their country.
Well, some of the people I talk with, they say they're surprisingly calm because they've been suffering from this bipartisan hybrid war for 25 years against Venezuela, trying to destabilize it. Actually, by many official reports from the CEPR and the Lancet, you know, thousands of people dying from the effects of sanctions. It is a much more dangerous time, they feel, but they feel very confident in their unity around defending their sovereignty, trust in their military to at least a show of force, that they're not going to just lie down and be taken over by the United States. It's calm, kind of a calm before the storm in a way, but with a lot of confidence and really trying to raise their voices to the world that this is not how nations should treat each other and act toward each other, that the U.S. is really acting like an international gangster, trying to coerce other countries to subordinate to political and economic interests of the United States. It's very tense, and every day there seems to be something new to have to respond to.
David, I did want to ask you, from your understanding inside Venezuela, is the nation's military solidly behind Nicolas Maduro and his government, or are the U.S. threats succeeding in sowing discord among commanding officers, which is a tactic that the U.S. has long employed against many nations, particularly in Latin America, with 100 years or more of intervention and military interventions and sponsoring coups by dictatorships and the like. But that's specifically a tactic that the U.S. has tried since Hugo Chavez was elected earlier this century.
Yeah, well, as you said, it's a tactic. They approach governments. They try to bribe them, threaten assassination, threaten coups, strikes, giving money to the opposition, and also going to the military to try to divide them and buy some of them off. In Venezuela, the military is very solidly with the government. One difference between the military there compared to what was in Chile when Pinochet overthrew Allende's government was most of the military were these professional officers, more middle-class officers. Most of the military in Venezuela are working-class origin, and they've seen and grown up with this political revolution that Chavez began, showing that the government does care about the working class, and even under all the economic hardship and blockade, showing a willingness to create social services for the people. You know, when push comes to shove, you know, people are human beings, and there's always going to be some who turn to the other side out of fear or persuasion. But we haven't seen that in any degree as yet.
Well, if the U.S. launches either very specific attacks against Venezuelan infrastructure or the like, or a full-blown invasion, how do you think the population will respond, given that there's a split in Venezuela, opponents and supporters of Maduro, certainly the economic problems in Venezuela, exacerbated by U.S. sanctions, have caused many people to immigrate to the United States, and many of them now have been deported back by the Trump administration. What's your sense of the nationalism in the country to oppose a foreign invasion versus people in the country who are opponents of Maduro? And you've got people like the preeminent leader of the opposition, Maria Corina Machado, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, welcoming an invasion.
The opposition is divided, but most of the opposition, by even opposition surveys and studies in just in the last year, have shown that the great majority of the opposition are against any invasion. They're actually against sanctions and agree with that what Machado has been saying, going around the world asking Netanyahu and Israel to help to invade their own country. They object to that. And it is a polarized society. You know, there's a large section of the private businesses that mostly against the government, and there's a lot of opposition media. But if the invasion happens, I think it will be pretty much a bloodbath. I mean, if they actually took out the leadership and took over the country, it'd probably be worse than what we saw in Allende with the torture and disappearing of tens of thousands of people. Even during these violent riots in 2014-2017, the violent opposition, headed by Machado, you know, sought out people who were Chavista supporters. They burned a number of them alive on video, burned government buildings. That's just a little taste of what we could see if an actual invasion happened. And those right-wing forces in Venezuela were given arms and supported by invading troops. It would be just a horror for Venezuela.
That was David Paul, a member of the Task Force on the Americas. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump regime's attack on boats in the Caribbean and threats to launch a regime change war against Venezuela by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZMO in Marion, Ohio, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KVRK in Sutton, Alaska, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.